Hello and welcome to Marketing in the Raw. That is the podcast, and I am the host, Adam Helway. It's my goal to expand how you define the practice of marketing and your vision of where it's headed, especially in a digitally connected world. In a recent Salesforce report of 8,000 consumers, 73% say trust in companies matter more than it did just a year ago. 89% said that they are more loyal to companies they trust, and 65% have stopped buying from companies they consider distrustful. These values have grown in importance over the years and continue to influence where customers spend their money. One of the biggest tools for building trust with your customers is transparency and the oft-overused word, authenticity. That's why I'm excited on this episode to talk with the super savvy Mr. Scott Monty. Scott is a strategic communications and leadership coach and an advisor who helps the C-suite embrace better communication with timeless and timely advice. He spent 6 years at Ford Motor Company as their first global head of social media and digital communications, where the former Ford CEO, Alan Mulally, called him a visionary. In this episode, Scott sheds light on how to build customer trust through the lens of strategic brand storytelling. I hope you enjoy both the timely and timeless advice imparted from my guest, Scott Monty. Scott Monty, so thankful that you are able to join me here today. How are things in your neck of the woods out there in Michigan?
Thank you, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, things are okay out here. We've actually had some unseasonably mild days. My daughter was out playing with water balloons in the yard this week because we peaked around 78 degrees in November. It's crazy. But we are actually a household that is partially overcoming a quarantine right now. We've had some sick folks, and we've done the isolation and the quarantine, and we're trying to be extra careful.
So hopefully everybody's on the upside of that, huh?
Not the upside of the curve that we're seeing across the country right now, but we're all on the mend.
Doing better on the mend. That's the better way of saying it. Well, you know, it's been some time since I've seen you, and you haven't seen me because I was in the audience while you were speaking at some place or another. It must have been either Content Marketing World or someplace like that. So it's great to be talking to you. I want to dig into a few different things that you speak a lot about. One of the first things I want to talk about and get out of the way, because I know I'm sure that folks ask this question a lot, but it has to do with going back to your time at Ford. And I found it really interesting that you were not just somebody who worked at Ford, but you were like the first executive over there that was dealing with leading digital communications and social media. I wondered, for a company that is over 100 years old, and at the time where you were there, I think it might have been just hitting that or something like that. What was it like to be bringing digital communications and social media to a company that's that old and you know, likely but not just large, but it's probably got a lot of well-established machinery internally, no pun intended.
No, you're absolutely right, Adam. Look, Ford, to its origins, you know, was a company about innovation. Henry Ford was not the first one to, tinker with automobiles, but he was the one who looked at other influences in manufacturing, in the meatpacking industry, in the textile industry, and he wove those ideas together and applied them to automotive and came up with the moving assembly line. Right. So he didn't invent the moving assembly line, but he did take it and apply it specifically to auto. So Ford has a heritage of being innovative, and when I got there in 2008. The company was in the process of trying to tell better stories about how its products were advancing in the 21st century. And it dovetailed with the evolution of the online industry of digital communications and social media. And I posited that probably around 2010, Ford would kind of come into its own in its latest iteration of technological advances. And the world of digital and social media would kind of come into its own in terms of becoming more widely used in the mainstream. And I thought where these two lines kind of intersect, there would be just this explosion of opportunity and activity. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, there were a lot of companies during the time. GM actually had beaten Ford to creating this kind of position. I knew my counterpart over at GM. But Ford's approach was fundamentally different because Ford was different. It, you know, we diverged in terms of the big government bailouts that were happening at the time during the carpocalypse. And that gave us an opportunity to act and speak differently. And we were very personal about it. You know, it's one of the reasons I, in my position, chose to go out front and to humanize the brand. I mean, we hear about that all the time now. You got to humanize the brand. Well, we were doing it back in 2008, and it was completely strategically consistent with what Ford had been doing for over 100 years. You think about it. Ford is the only automotive company where the name of the founder is still on the logo today. And Henry Ford was an icon of the business world. And I recall when Steve Jobs died in 2011, his name was mentioned alongside Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, these titans of industry and innovation. And so we had the ability and the calling card through the personality behind the brand, and we just continued to extend that in the 21st century.
I love that reminder that for those that think of Ford, there's much more to it than even just the automotive industry. That and oftentimes we think of technology as being, especially now, these like very connected digital devices, and we often forget about where that word technology can be applied to. And Ford, as you said, was a technology leader, not to say that they're not right now, but definitely what I mean is cutting edge for a lot of what was going on in technology over those 100 plus years, and to align that with sort of this new fourth industrial age, so to speak, is actually a really interesting way of positioning it. What was the biggest challenge that you had to overcome during that time? And could you share how you overcame it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, at companies of this size, there's always going to be challenges. There's going to be cultural challenges. There's going to be lots of politics, regardless of where you are. Ford was renowned for its politics and infighting. And when Alan Mulally came along as the CEO, he came from outside the industry. He came from Boeing. And there were a lot of people there that were skeptical of Alan. And he said he recalls in the first town hall with employees that he did, somebody said, Mr. Mulally, are you sure you're ready for this? I mean, you know, building a car, you know, there's 30,000 moving parts, there's a moving assembly line. It's very complex. And Alan said, look, I come from the manufacturing industry. We manufactured airplanes, not cars, but I understand. We dealt with unions and lawyers and regulators, and we had to worry about our customers and our shareholders, all the things we're doing here at Ford. And then he said, and we had to build vehicles out of a million parts, and we had to keep our product suspended 6 feet over the earth. So I think I'm going to be okay, right? So in that level of a little bit of churlishness, but a little bit of humility as well, Alan reminded everyone that he understood the challenges and that he was there to meet them with everyone. And it's really about using analogies that people can understand. And that's what I found out early on. There were other executives, in particular, our chief financial officer, who we're skeptical about digital communications and social media. Is it a waste of time? Are we losing productivity with employees? Why are we wasting our time and resources on this, which seems kind of superfluous when we could be doing other things? And I went into a meeting up in the Thunderbird room, up on the top floor of the Ford World headquarters. It's a big room with this round table and all the chairs are around it, and there's cameras on the inside so you can see people from Asia and South America and Europe. And it felt like the war room in Dr. Strangelove. And I had to give a presentation on the state of social media, the industry at large, and then specifically as to how Ford was doing. And the rest of the executives around the table, this was probably around 2010, 2011 or so, were all concerned about rising gas prices. And, we're hammering on fuel economy. And I said, look, before I give this presentation, I'm going to go into our corporate Twitter account. I'm going to ask the question, what's the minimum MPG, miles per gallon, you'd like to see from your next vehicle?
Hmm.
Send. Okay, I gave my presentation. I was seated between the chief financial officer and the chief operating officer, the latter of whom went on to become the next CEO of Ford after Alan stepped down. So, this is the big boy table. And we got to the end of the presentation, and I went back into the Twitter account, and there were, 100 or so replies. And people said, everything from, don't matter what the MPG is, as long as it got a V8 engine in it. All the way up to 300 miles per gallon, which at the time, we weren't really thinking about. That was kind of farther out in terms of electric vehicles. But Ford was doing hybrids and other things. But most of the mentions, most of the responses were in the 30s and 40s miles per gallon. And this was exactly what Ford had targeted for its fleet in the coming 3 years. So it was a validation to all of those executives sitting around the table. And the CFO, who's sitting next to me, he had his glasses kind of like down on his nose, and he takes them off and he puts them up on his forehead and he pushes back from the table and he says, do you know, if I had insights like this every day, I would find it invaluable. And I thought, well, game, set, and match. We just demonstrated to the CFO how to take this technology and harness it so that it is relevant to him and his world. And it was a great lesson for me about creating analogies and creating contextual relevance for people to help them see the power of technology.
I love that story. You also made a connection with me because you talk about storytelling, strategic storytelling, quite a bit. And I realized that with your time at Ford, you were at a company that had so many rich narratives to be able to peel back and share with folks. You talk about strategic storytelling as a way to connect with customers and inspire them to take action. How would you describe how most brands, Ford is obviously, it's got a long history again, as we just talked about, but for some of the other companies that are out there, how are they communicating in contrast to being strategic in their storytelling, and how should they be, what could they be doing to build a more engaging narrative, with maybe a company that's 5 years, 10 years, 15 years old instead?
Yeah. It's a great question, Adam. And I think the common flaw that I see in so much corporate storytelling is how the companies, the brand managers, the corporate communications people are so excited to talk about whatever it is that they're doing. And I often say, look, unless you are Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts, no one wakes up first thing in the morning thinking about your brand. They have other priorities. They are trying to get to the first Zoom call, trying to get the kids off to school or prep for now homeschooling. They're trying to figure out how many meetings they have in a day, when they're going to pick up the dry cleaning, how about that PTA meeting, who's cooking lunch and dinner and all the rest. So we need to keep this in mind that our audience does not have the same priorities that we do, first and foremost. The second is, when you do that, who is the hero in your story? It's classic storytelling. There's a hero, an anti-hero, a challenge that needs to be overcome, et cetera. Most brands will position themselves as the hero. It's natural. We've got the ultimate, problem-solving technology that can help you out of any jam. Well, okay, great. But if you're not making the customer the hero in a particular story, they're gonna tune out, right? If the hero is on a journey and it's disrupted by some sort of challenge that's thrown in their way, and the company is the thing that allows them to overcome the challenge, then they're a supporting member of the story. They're still really important, but they're not the hero, right? The hero is what's centered on the customer. And this is where, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about customer-centric marketing, another overused term, customer centricity. But it's really all about that, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, having some empathy, and being able to think through the lens of storytelling as you'd want it if you weren't associated with that company, right? And it's really hard to do that because we are so wrapped up in all of the internal meetings and the progress and, you know, everything we know from talking to ourselves. But we need to start getting out of our own bubbles and thinking about this from someone else's perspective.
What's technology's role in enabling storytelling for brands these days?
Well, look, I think there are more ways to tell stories than there ever have been before, whether it's visual, video, audio, just audio, text. There's so many creative ways to make it happen. And you need to think through the best medium to help tell your story. And I thought this through with a number of executives on the Ford team. We had a brilliant chief product designer, chief engineer. He could tell some great stories, but he was not the most, shall we say, engaging person on camera. All right. Well, he was an engineer. You know, what do you expect? So we put him behind the scenes. We gave him, you know, we recorded what he had to say, and then we typed it up. Gary had a transcript, and he was more of a textual guy. Our CEO was a genuine guy through and through. We got him on camera as much as we could. And we were able to take our story and do, this term's been around for a good dozen years or so, transmedia storytelling, right? Take them from one platform to the other and understand what the audience on each platform expects out of you and what the norms are on that kind of platform. And have specialists in each one of these that can really help your team understand the best way to tell a particular story on a particular platform.
I think that's really important. As you were saying, a lot of times folks see that a particular medium channel, it could be a social network, it could be a device, whatever the case may be, tends to be trending up in its usage, and they think too hard about letting that lead the strategy versus what is the right medium to tell this story? That's one part of what you said. And then secondly, is to be sort of transmedia, you need to clearly understand the customer journey or customer experience, because then when you clearly understand how your particular customers spend their time and attention and you know, peruse around their digital life, then you know how to connect that narrative across those different channels and experiences much better. You can be a bit more omnipresent in that way. That's a part of what you were talking about, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's going to be, you know, as we used to say in the auto industry, your mileage will vary. It's going to be different for every company, for every team, for every audience. And you need to keep testing what's going on. That's why analytics are so important. You need to understand what's being picked up, what's not. What are people saying about you? What are they saying about your competition that they're not saying about you, good and bad, right? Again, everything doesn't center around you, but you need to understand what the rest of the world is talking about. So when you do show up, you're not like a boor who just crashes into a party, hands his business card out to everybody, and then walks out the door. Right.
Yep.
It's really about having a good sense. It comes down to things I talk with leaders about all the time in terms of emotional intelligence. Right. You need to be able to read a room. You need to be able to make a frank self-assessment. You need to be aware of what other people are feeling and how they're going to respond. It's not easy work all the time, but if you've got the right tools and you've got the right people on the team, it can really come alive.
You talk about trust, and I love this. This is something that I talk about as well. There's almost no better thing to help you connect with customers besides empathy and trust. And in a recent Salesforce report of 8,000 consumers, 73% say that trust in companies matter more than it did a year ago, which I'm sure has continued to increase year over year. And 89% said that they are more loyal to companies that they trust, and 65% have stopped buying from companies altogether that they consider distrustful. As someone that talks about trust a lot, I'm sure this isn't news to you in any way, but what is marketing and communications' role in helping to build trust with customers?
Well, I think it's absolutely showing up the way that you've told people to expect that you should show up. There's got to be some degree of regularity there, of consistency of message, consistency of and frequency of message. It really comes down to being honest and I know this is another word that gets overused a lot, transparent with people. We talked about transparency and authenticity back when I was first starting at Ford. People can see through a mile, people can see through BS from a mile away, no question. But if you don't have anything to be authentic about, then, you've basically got nothing. So it starts with a sense of honesty and transparency, that you're not misleading them with spurious claims or with over-promising, right? You're giving them expectations and you're meeting those expectations. Maybe in some cases you're exceeding those expectations, which is always great when you can do it. And then ultimately, if you do these things consistently and repeatedly over time, right? Because trust isn't built in a day, just like Rome wasn't built in a day, then you will find yourself having these relationships, these deepening relationships with people. And it may not be a huge group of people. Maybe that's not what you need. But even if you've got that solid core of people, and look, this includes relationships and trust and loyalty that you're building internally with your employees, as well as with your customers, really with all of your stakeholders. Okay. But truth is a down payment on loyalty. Okay, I'm going to say that again. Truth is a down payment on loyalty, because loyalty doesn't come through transactions. It comes from trust, right? And you don't get trust simply by making a sale. You get trust by welcoming people and, again, being honest with them. And in some cases, showing them how the sausage is made. Not literally, obviously, but bringing them on the inside, giving them the inside scoop as to how you make decisions. The challenges that you've had as a team, whether it's as a management team or a design team or an execution team, and getting something out the door. People appreciate that, right? They feel that you've given them something, so they feel like they owe you something back. And again, this isn't a transaction. It's about deepening relationships. And so you've got honesty that leads to transparency. You've got transparency that leads to trust, and trust leads to loyalty. And when you've got loyalty, it means less turnover of employees, less turnover of your customer base. And that's what people are looking for long-term, is growth. And you can grow by acquiring new customers and bringing in new employees, but you can also grow by not losing any or losing fewer over the course of time.
Well, and not only that, in addition to it, right, that you have more loyal customers, or customers that have a high level of trust, are going to refer folks more often, right? And in doing so, it's there's so much to be said for having your friend or somebody else, that transient trust that happens when another human being refers you, versus the brand again shouting from the rooftops how cool they are, come buy from us. When I go, some folks wonder why people go to someplace like Facebook or elsewhere and say, hey, I want to buy this, that, and the other. What do you think about it? Or what has been your experience versus just simply going over to Google and Googling for something? And it's because of that human trust element within their network. They're willing to listen there. They feel like they're getting an outside opinion that's not loaded by the company.
I wanted to raise one other thing too, and yeah. That is that back to storytelling before, people appreciate not only going behind the scenes, but they appreciate an origin story, right? So even if you are not, even if you don't have the heritage of a Coca-Cola or a Ford Motor Company with over a century in business, people still like to know how you got where you got. Even if you started your business last year, what inspired you? Who were the people that helped you along the way? You know, those are all stories that we have within us, right? Aside from that, people appreciate humor, right? What's something funny that happened in a team meeting or in a planning session or with a customer? People appreciate being made the center of attention. What if you could highlight a customer or an employee? Right. And here we go, get back to what you were just talking about in terms of word of mouth. They're going to be more likely to share a story that's relatable. And you can be sure they're going to be likely to tell a story that's about them. They want to they want to show the world how they were part of your story.
It's a good reminder that not always is it about sharing or sharing a story about your brand, but in creating moments that provide opportunities for customers to tell stories about your brand.
That's exactly right. We had a project at Ford years ago. It was called My Ford Story, it was the Ford Story, but we changed it over to My Ford Story, and we collected stories about customers. And I'll never forget, there was one. And we asked people to share pictures of their cars, which were obviously part of why they were writing in. There was one from a 77-year-old grandmother who had just bought a Mustang 5.0, Mustang GT 5.0, so she could race her grandson, who also had a Mustang. I mean, we couldn't make up the racing grandma in a Mustang 5.0 if we, you know, stood on our heads. This was authentic, and it was just driven by love for the brand. And she was going around showing off the site to everybody who would look, right? And we tried to do that on a regular basis and pick these little gems out of people who were just inspiring and that other people could relate to. Because that's one of the other things about trust is people have told us time and again, the Edelman Trust Barometer confirms this over 20 years, who do people trust most? They trust people like themselves, somebody they can relate to. They'll always trust a third-party expert or an academic, less so somebody who works for a company. But if you can show them somebody like them, that's right at the top of the list. And we tried to do that again and again.
You know, I'm really interested in this question, and I was debating on whether to ask it or not. But I know you and how you sort of your worldview, and I would really appreciate your thoughts on this. We're talking about being more transparent, and we're talking about building trust. And you talk about folks doing business; they like to do business with people they that are like them. We're living in an age right now where folks also want to do business with people that have some level of shared values, and being in America and an American, and seeing sort of the way that things have been going lately with social media and elsewhere, there seems to be a little bit more of a divide now that's being created from people who are being more polarized to sort of glom on to communities and be a little less tolerant of other communities. When it comes to brands, I want to know what your thoughts are on that and how brands who might be a little bit concerned or afraid about how transparent that they want to be in regards to their values or things that they stand up for. What are your thoughts on folks who may be concerned about doing that?
Yeah, I think it's a very real concern, and it's a very fine line. I wrote a topic in my Timeless and Timely newsletter a couple of weeks ago about mixing business and politics, and is it ever okay? And frankly, I think most of the time we should probably try to separate them out, but there come times in a society when something happens. And, I pick the crisis of the moment. But when something happens and it goes against the grain of the values that your company stands for, I think you not only have a right to speak up, but you probably have a responsibility to speak up as well. Because companies, by and large, have a larger platform than individuals. And yeah, your employees as individuals are all going to have their own platforms, but they also have diversity of thought as well. If you are running a company and you have a set of values that you adhere to, and it's part of your strategy and it's part of how you go to market, then you have a responsibility to show up and to say something when those values are being stepped on or infringed upon, or when they hurt your customer base. And you don't need to do it in a way that alienates people, but simply to show what you do stand for. And there's a term. I remember there's a P.G. Woodhouse story called "Noblesse Oblige," and it literally means the obligations of the noble class. Right? There are and it comes right down to what we've heard from Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility, right? And that's something that can be traced all the way back to the Bible, right? We know that if we are put in a position of power by virtue of leadership, by virtue of a position in the marketplace, that we have an obligation to use our power for good. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we alienate people along the way, but simply that we put a stake in the ground and say, this is what I stand for. And if some people don't like that, then perhaps they're not the right target audience for your brand or for your company. And in this day and age, I think it's okay to be niche in terms of your marketing, in terms of who you talk to. You don't need to be somebody that serves everyone. You can be very specific about who it is you want to serve. And again, if something is going against the grain of your founding ideals, then I think you have to say something.
Along that same lines, if you don't just suddenly start digging your well when you need water, but you're building that trust and that relationship and connection with those customers over time, so this is not your first foray into suddenly being transparent and trying to communicate your values and this and that and the other, I think it'll go a lot better, right? It's very similar to people. There's less likelihood that they're going to potentially take it the wrong way or feel alienated because they understand who you are, your values, and that because of that long-term interaction that they've had with you.
Absolutely. And look, I'll give you a real life example. And this isn't even political. This is a company knowing what it stood for and having to draw the line in the sand. Southwest Airlines has always been very accommodating when it comes to customers, very customer-centric from the get-go. And, if something goes wrong on a flight, they want to hear about it because they want to improve and they want to make you happy at the same time. So years ago, back when Herb Kelleher, the founder, was CEO, there was a customer, a little old woman by the name of Martha, who was like a squeaky wheel. Every flight she went on, she found something wrong. It was too hot. It was too cold. She didn't get enough peanuts. She got too many peanuts. She didn't like the boarding process. And she always wrote a letter in, and the customer service team would stand by the ideals of the company and continue to send Martha, more miles or points or tickets or what have you to appease Martha and make her happy. But at a certain point, they just felt like Martha was abusing the system. And she wrote in, Martha wrote in again or called in again, and the customer service team bumped it up to Herb. And they go, Herb, this one's all yours. You handle it. And 2 minutes later, they had a response from Herb where he scribbled across the email that was sent to him very simply, Dear Martha, we will miss you. Love, Herb. And that's it, right? And he knew he even though it went against the ideals of the company, he had to make a stand because Martha would have continued walking all over them and making fools of the customer service team that Herb was now in service to, not the customer, right? And in doing so, it seemed like it was against what the company stood for, and yet at the same time, it was very much in protecting another base of stakeholders that were important to Herb, and that was his customer service people.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The employees and in his team as well. I love that story. Speaking of your, I think you call it the Timely and Timeless newsletter. Is that what it is?
Timeless and Timely.
Yep. Timeless and Timely. I said them in the wrong way. It was a 50-50 right. chance.
It's irrelevant.
So in one of your recent newsletters, you dedicated an entire section to the topic of having to wait improves decision-making. And to quote you, and this quote that I really loved was, not everything needs your attention now. This advice is great for anyone, but do you think that marketing and communications departments are moving too fast in an age of sort of push button publishing and social media?
Well, absolutely. And I think this has happened for a long time. We've become a slave to technology. I had a client a few years ago who was a car dealer in Queens, New York, and he was at the top of his game, number one in the country in used sales, number three in new car sales for this particular automaker. And he came to me and he said, Scott, I need your help. And I said, Brian, you're at the top of your game. What do you need help with? He said, no, you don't understand. The dealership industry is broken and we're getting hammered by Apple and Amazon. And I said, you know, that's actually a good point. Even though Apple and Amazon don't sell cars yet, it's the buy it now feature. It's the deliver it today feature. It's this instantaneous gratification that we've driven into our collective culture by virtue of technology. Must have things now. It's going to ruin it for dealers, right? And we moved him to a model of kind of direct delivery where people could have their cars picked up in their driveway, taken in for service, get texts in real time as to what was going on with pictures, right? So that trust was built up rather than the black hole that you're used to your car going into when it goes into the dealership. And that actually led to people spending more money with the dealer on repairs because they felt like they could trust him, right? And again, it dovetailed with this instant gratification, and it took a while for us to put this all together. We cobbled it together through a bunch of different systems, but it was a way that worked. When it comes to communications and marketing, we feel like we need to respond, you know, like in the blink of an eye. And the bottom line is things aren't as slow moving as they were even 10 years ago when you could stop a crisis from happening on Twitter. Now it's completely out of control, right? So it may be time to luxuriate in that, knowing that you're not going to be able to stop something from happening and using the extra time that you're going to give yourself to think something through, rather than simply having a knee-jerk response, an autonomic response to what's happening. Because you can get yourself in a lot of trouble if you just go based on instinct or if you go based on rumor or whatever happens to be right in front of you at the time. If you step back, take some time to reflect, put it into perspective. You know, I'll never forget, there was a book I was reading about everything that happened within the 24 hours around September 11th, the hours leading up to it and the aftermath. And Peter Jennings, who was the anchor for ABC World News Tonight for many years, was manning the live coverage desk at ABC, as he did for many, many crises. And he said, you know, we're just going to sit and watch these images, watch the buildings as they burn, because we don't have to have something to say all the time. We can let the images speak for themselves. We can let our silence speak for itself. And people are so afraid of having a silence. In talks that I give, I pause a lot because I want people to take time to think about what it is I'm saying. And people are so not used to having a silence. There's even settings on podcast apps where you can skip silences. And to me, that defeats the purpose of someone who fundamentally understands the importance of timing. Right? I think we need to build more silence into our lives. There's a great book. Here it is right here. From Ryan Holiday. Stillness is the key. Right? It's Stoic philosophy. It's just about taking some time to breathe, taking the world in around you, getting out of yourself for a while, and not feeling like you have to have something to do or say or respond to all the time.
I love that. I've found over the last couple of years, especially as I give to some extent part of the general term around that for me is mindfulness. Mindfulness in that it makes room. It makes more room than you think. It makes room for things to be for things to be thought through more deeply. And in many cases, for instance, just recently, we had an account management issue, in all transparency, and my gut reaction is to fix that fast, is to solve the problem quickly, is to address it and be there. And I found that pausing and breathing and then just waiting one extra day changed how I wanted to respond to it in a dramatically more positive way, in my opinion.
That 24 hours, or I'm even counting to 10 sometimes. Yep. Which seems like 24 hours in the digital world, is powerful. Abraham Lincoln was once so incensed at, I think it was General McClellan, for his lack of response or his lack of aggression in going after the Confederate troops. He wrote a nasty gram to the general, telling him all of his failings. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln, when you consider all of our U.S. presidents, I'm a bit of a presidential historian buff, presidential history buff. You wouldn't normally think of Abraham Lincoln as a hothead, you know? He was a great steady hand that had to get us to the Civil War. He had so much angst over it and reflected many, many hours on, was he doing the right thing and was he not? So he wrote this letter, this really nasty letter to a general, and then he put it in a drawer and he never sent it. Because for him, it was cathartic just getting that stuff out on paper. And whether it's an email or a Facebook comment or a reply tweet, we've got the space to write whatever it is that we want, but we also have the decision whether or not to hit that send button. And there's nothing that says you must hit send after you've typed that response out. Like Lincoln, it can be very cathartic to get that vitriol out onto the page and then to simply delete it. And I think we owe ourselves that more often, more opportunities than not.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. So Scott, I have one final, like, this is the ultimate question. Okay. This is the final shebang here at the end of the interview. So are you ready for it?
Hit me.
Okay. All right. So you love to use timeless lessons from history and literature and philosophy in your keynotes and newsletter, and you did it a few times during this interview. Is there a timeless lesson that you found wisdom in revisiting throughout your life that just keeps on revealing new lessons for you?
Wow. To me, I think the most important thing is to be a lifelong learner. You know, I spent way too much time in college and graduate school. And ironically, you know, decades later, I'm finding it more useful to me now than it was right when I got out of school. And I think it's largely because I'm a reader. I'm an information junkie in general, but I'm a reader.
He's saying this, by the way, with tons of books behind him and literally every inch of the desk behind him covered in books. So really, Scott, you're a reader? Who would have thunk?
I know, right? But to me, that willingness to continue to learn is something that's so important in leadership. We all have lessons to learn. Even from the most junior employee on our team, they have experiences and perspectives that we simply don't. You know, I've learned a lot in the last year or two about the plight of Black Americans. That, you know, me as a, you know, middle-aged white guy has never had to confront in my life, and I'm fortunate for that. It is what we call white privilege. But I took the time to watch and to listen and to learn. And, you know, I know empathy is something that's really important to you, Adam. And I think combining our willingness to learn with a sense of empathy, right, knowing that there are others who have different experiences and that we can feel what they feel if we put ourselves in their shoes, opens us up to becoming so much more of what our potential is than if we were simply closed off to the rest of the world.
I love that. So I said, I love that plenty of times, Scott. You've got a lot more I love that's out of me than usual interviews. So I appreciate the wisdom. How can people learn more about you, stay connected with you, see what you're up to?
Easiest way is simply to go to my website, scottmonty.com. You can read some of the entries there, sign up for the newsletter, see what I work with clients about, and get in touch with me.
And I highly recommend that you check out the section on his newsletter. As we mentioned, there's some really good stuff in there. Scott, I super appreciate the opportunity to reconnect with you in digital face-to-face magic here. And I hope that at some point I bump into you in person again soon. And I certainly would like to talk to you again in the next year. So thanks again for joining me.
You got it, Adam. Thanks so much.
Hey, you made it to the end. Thank you for listening to the Marketing in the Raw podcast. I'm super happy that you spent time with us. If you could do one thing, it would be incredible if you could subscribe to this podcast. And if you've already done so, then kudos to you. If you found anything interesting in this podcast that you think a colleague might like, then I really recommend that you share it with them, send it to them in an email, or even, you know, just share it with your social networks. It helps us get out there and spread the word. Last but not least, if you wanted to connect with me in any way, ask some questions about digital marketing, you've got a problem you need us to solve, or just in general want to connect, you can find me at adam@secretsushi.com. That's my email. Or just visit us at secretsushi.com. Thanks. Take care.